Chapter 85. The wedding, gone with its passionless blank face, steals shivering to the church beneath which lies the dust of little Paul and his mother, and looks in at the windows. It is cold and dark. Night crouches yet upon the pavement, and broods, somber and heavy, in nooks and corners of the building. The steeple clock, perched up above the houses, emerging from beneath another of the countless ripples in the tide of time that regularly roll and break on the eternal shore, is grayly visible, like a stone beacon, recording how the sea flows on. But within doors, dawn, at first, can only peep at night and see that it is there. Hovering feebly round the church and looking in, dawn moans and weeps for its short rain, and its tears trickle on the window glass, and the trees against the church wall bow their heads and wring their many hands in sympathy. Night, growing pale before it, gradually fades out of the church, but lingers in the vaults below and sits upon the coffins. And now comes bright day, burnishing the steeple clock, and reddening the spire, and drying up the tears of dawn, and stifling its complaining. And the dawn, following the night, and chasing it from its last refuge, shrinks into the vaults itself and hides, with a frightened face, among the dead, until night returns, refreshed, to drive it out. And now, the mice, who have been busier with the prayer books than their proper owners, and with the hassocks, more worn by their little teeth than by human knees, hide their bright eyes in their holes, and gather close together in affright at the resounding clashing of the church door. For the beadle, that man of power, comes early this morning with the sexton, and Mrs. Miff, the wheezy little pew-opener, a mighty dry old lady, sparely dressed, with not an inch of fullness anywhere about her, is also here, and has been waiting at the church gate half an hour, as her place is, for the beadle. A vinegary face has Mrs. Miff, and a mortified bonnet, and eke a thirsty soul for sixpences and shillings. Beckoning to stray people, to come into pews, has given Mrs. Miff an air of mystery. And there is reservation in the eye of Mrs. Miff, as always knowing of a softer seat, but having her suspicions of the fee. There is no such fact as Mr. Miff, nor has there been, these 20 years, and Mrs. Miff would rather not allude to him. He held some bad opinions, it would seem, about free seats, and though Mrs. Miff hopes he may be gone upwards, she couldn't positively undertake to say so. Busy is Mrs. Miff this morning at the church door, beating and dusting the altar cloth, the carpet, and the cushions, and much has Mrs. Miff to say about the wedding they are going to have. Mrs. Miff is told that the new furniture and alterations in the house cost full £5,000, if they cost a penny, and Mrs. Miff has heard, upon the best authority, that the lady hasn't got a sixpence wherewithal to bless herself. Mrs. Miff remembers, likewise, as if it had happened yesterday, the first wife's funeral, and then the christening, and then the other funeral, and Mrs. Miff says, by the by, she'll soap and water that ear tablet presently, against the company arrive. Mr. Sounds the beadle, who is sitting in the sun upon the church steps all this time and seldom does anything else, except, in cold weather, sitting by the fire, approves of Mrs. Miff's discourse, and asks if Mrs. Miff has heard it said that the lady is uncommon handsome. The information Mrs. Miff has received, being of this nature, Mr. Sounds the beadle, who, though orthodox and corpulent, is still an admirer of female beauty, observes, with unction, yes, he hears she is a spanker, an expression that seems somewhat forcible to Mrs. Miff, or would, from any lips but those of Mr. Sounds the beadle. In Mr. Dombey's house, at this same time, there is great stir and bustle, more especially among the women. Not one of whom has had a wink of sleep since 4 o'clock, and all of whom were fully dressed before 6. Mr. Towlinson is an object of greater consideration than usual to the housemaid, and the cook says at breakfast time that one wedding makes many, which the housemaid can't believe, and don't think true at all. Mr. Towlinson reserves his sentiments on this question, being rendered something gloomy by the engagement of a foreigner with whiskers. Mr. Towlinson is whiskerless himself, who has been hired to accompany the happy pair to Paris, and who is busy packing the new chariot. In respect of this personage, Mr. Towlinson admits, presently, that he never knew of any good that ever come of foreigners, and being charged by the ladies with prejudice, says, look at Bonaparte who was at the head of them, and see what he was always up to. Which the housemaid says is very true. The pastry cook is hard at work in the funereal room in Brook Street, and the very tall young men are busy looking on. One of the very tall young men already smells of sherry, and his eyes have a tendency to become fixed in his head, and to stare at objects without seeing them. The very tall young man is conscious of this failing in himself, and informs his comrade that it's his exciseman. Apostrophe the very tall young man would say excitement, but his speech is hazy. The men who play the bells have got scent of the marriage, and the marrow bones and cleavers too, and a brass band too. The first are practicing in a back settlement near Battle Bridge. The second put themselves in communication, through their chief, with Mr. Towlinson, to whom they offer terms to be bought off. And the third, in the person of an artful trombone, lurks and dodges round the corner, waiting for some traitor tradesman, to reveal the place and hour of breakfast, for a bribe. Expectation and excitement extend further yet, and take a wider range. From Ball's Pond, Mr. Perch brings Mrs. Perch, to spend the day with Mr. Dombey's servants, and accompany them, surreptitiously, to see the wedding. In Mr. Toots' lodgings, Mr. Toots attires himself, as if he were at least the bridegroom, determined to behold the spectacle in splendor from a secret corner of the gallery, and thither to convey the chicken. For it is Mr. Toots' desperate intent to point out Florence to the chicken, then and there, and openly to say, now, chicken, I will not deceive you any longer. The friend I have sometimes mentioned to you is myself. Miss Dombey is the object of my passion. What are your opinions, chicken, in this state of things, and what, on the spot, do you advise? The so much to be astonished chicken, in the meanwhile, dips his beak into a tankard of strong beer in Mr. Toots' kitchen, and pecks up 2 pounds of beefsteaks. In Princess's Plus, Miss Tox is up and doing, for she too, though in sore distress, is resolved to put a shilling in the hands of Mrs. Miff, and see the ceremony which has a cruel fascination for her, from some lonely corner. The quarters of the wooden midshipmen are all alive, for Captain Cuttle, in his ankle jacks, and with a huge shirt collar, is seated at his breakfast, listening to Rob the Grinder as he reads the marriage service to him beforehand, under orders, to the end, that the captain may perfectly understand the solemnity he is about to witness. For which purpose, the captain gravely lays injunctions on his chaplain, from time to time, to put about, apostrophe or to overhaul that ear article again, or to stick to his own duty, and leave the amends to him, the captain, one of which he repeats, whenever a pause is made by Rob the Grinder, with sonorous satisfaction. Besides all this, and much more, 20 nursery maids in Mr. Dombey's street alone, have promised 20 families of little women, whose instinctive interest in nuptials dates from their cradles, that they shall go and see the marriage. Truly, Mr. Sounds the Beadle has good reason to feel himself in office, as he suns his portly figure on the church steps, waiting for the marriage hour. Truly, Mrs. Miff has cause to pounce on an unlucky dwarf child, with a giant baby, who peeps in at the porch, and drive her forth with indignation. Cousin Phoenix has come over from abroad, expressly to attend the marriage. Cousin Phoenix was a man about town, 40 years ago, but he is still, so juvenile in figure and in manner, and so well got up, that strangers are amazed, when they discover latent wrinkles in his lordship's face, and crow's feet in his eyes, and first observe him, not exactly certain when he walks across a room, of going quite straight to where he wants to go. But Cousin Phoenix, getting up at 7:30 or so, is quite another thing from Cousin Phoenix got up, and very dim, indeed, he looks, while being shaved at Long's Hotel, in Bond Street. Mr. Dombey leaves his dressing room, amidst a general whisking away of the women on the staircase, who disperse in all directions, with a great rustling of skirts, except Mrs. Perch, who, being but that she always is, in an interesting situation, is not nimble, and is obliged to face him, and is ready to sink with confusion as she courtesies. May heaven avert all evil consequences from the house of Perch. Mr. Dombey walks up to the drawing room, to bide his time. Gorgeous are Mr. Dombey's new blue coat, fawn-colored pantaloons, and lilac waistcoat, and a whisper goes about the house that Mr. Dombey's hair is curled. A double knock announces the arrival of the major, who is gorgeous too, and wears a whole geranium in his buttonhole, and has his hair curled tight and crisp, as well the native knows. Dombey. ... says the major, putting out both hands, how are you? ... ... says Mr. Dombey, how are you? ... by Jove, sir, ... says the major, Joey B is in such case this morning, sir, ... and here he hits himself hard upon the breast in such case this morning, sir, that, damn, Dombey, he has half a mind to make a double marriage of it, sir, and take the mother. ... Mr. Dombey smiles, but faintly, even for him. For Mr. Dombey feels that he is going to be related to the mother, and that, under those circumstances, she is not to be joked about. ... says the major, seeing this, I give you joy. I congratulate you, Dombey. By the Lord, sir, ... says the major, you are more to be envied, this day, than any man in England. ... here again Mr. Dombey's assent is qualified, because he is going to confer a great distinction on a lady, and, no doubt, she is to be envied most. As to Edith Granger, sir, ... pursues the major, there is not a woman in all Europe but might and would, sir, you will allow backstock to add, and would give her ears, and her earrings to be in Edith Granger's place. ... You are good enough to say so, major, ... says Mr. Dombey. ... returns the major, you know it. Let us have no false delicacy. You know it. Do you know it, or do you not, Dombey? ... says the major, almost in a passion. Oh, really, major, ... damn, sir, ... retorts the major, do you know that fact, or do you not? Dombey. Is old Joe your friend? Are we on that footing of unreserved intimacy, Dombey, that may justify a man a blunt old Joseph B. sir in speaking out? Or am I to take open order, Dombey, and to keep my distance, and to stand on forms? ... my dear Major Backstock, ... says Mr. Dombey, with a gratified air, you are quite warm. ... by gad, sir, ... says the Major, I am warm. Joseph B. does not deny it, Dombey. He is warm. This is an occasion, sir, that calls forth all the honest sympathies remaining in an old, infernal, battered, used up, invalided, J.B. carcass. And I tell you what, Dombey, at such a time a man must blurt out what he feels, or put a muzzle on, and Joseph Backstock tells you to your face, Dombey, as he tells his club behind your back, that he never will be muzzled when Paul Dombey is in question. Now, damn, sir, ... concludes the major, with great firmness, what do you make of that? ... major, ... says Mr. Dombey, I assure you that I am really obliged to you. I had no idea of checking your too partial friendship. ... not too partial, sir. ... exclaims the choleric major. Dombey, I deny it. ... your friendship I will say then, ... pursues Mr. Dombey, on any account. Nor can I forget, Major, on such an occasion as the present, how much I am indebted to it. ... Dombey, ... says the Major, with appropriate action, that is the hand of Joseph Backstock. Of plain old Joey B. sir, if you like that better. That is the hand of which His Royal Highness the late Duke of York did me the honor to observe, sir, to His Royal Highness the late Duke of Kent, that it was the hand of Josh, a rough and tough, and possibly an up to snuff, old vagabond. Dommy, may the present moment be the least unhappy of our lives. God bless you. Apostrophe, now enters Mr. Carker, gorgeous likewise, and smiling like a wedding guest indeed. He can scarcely let Mr. Dombey's hand go, he is so congratulatory, and he shakes the Major's hand so heartily at the same time, that his voice shakes too, in accord with his arms, as it comes sliding from between his teeth. The very day is auspicious, apostrophe says Mr. Carker. The brightest and most genial weather. I hope I am not a moment late. Apostrophe, punctual to your time, sir, apostrophe says the Major. I am rejoiced, I am sure, apostrophe says Mr. Carker. I was afraid I might be a few seconds after the appointed time, for I was delayed by a procession of wagons, and I took the liberty of riding round to Brook Street this to Mr. Dombey, to leave a few poor rarities of flowers for Mrs. Dombey. A man in my position, and so distinguished, as to be invited here, is proud to offer some homage in acknowledgement of his vassalage. And as I have no doubt Mrs. Dombey is overwhelmed with what is costly and magnificent, apostrophe with a strange glance at his patron, I hope the very poverty of my offering may find favor for it. Apostrophe, Mrs. Dombey, that is to be, apostrophe returns Mr. Dombey, condescendingly, will be very sensible of your attention, Carker, I am sure. Apostrophe, and if she is to be Mrs. Dombey this morning, sir, apostrophe says the Major, putting down his coffee cup, and looking at his watch, it's high time we were off. Apostrophe, apostrophe, forth, in a barrage. Ride Mr. Dombey, Major Backstock, and Mr. Carker, to the church. Mr. Sounds the Beadle has long risen from the steps, and is in waiting with his cocked hat in his hand. Mrs. Miff curtsies, and proposes chairs in the vestry. Mr. Dombey prefers remaining in the church. As he looks up at the organ, Miss Tox in the gallery shrinks behind the fat leg of a cherubim on a monument, with cheeks like a young wind. Captain Cuttle, on the contrary, stands up and waves his hook, in token of welcome and encouragement. Mr. Toots informs the chicken, behind his hand, that the middle gentleman, he in the fawn-colored pantaloons, is the father of his love. The chicken hoarsely whispers Mr. Toots, that he's as stiff a cove as ever he see, but that it is within the resources of science to double him up, with one blow in the waistcoat. Mr. Sounds and Mrs. Miff are eyeing Mr. Dombey from a little distance, when the noise of approaching wheels is heard, and Mr. Sounds goes out. Mrs. Miff, meeting Mr. Dombey's eye as it is withdrawn from the presumptuous maniac upstairs, who salutes him with so much urbanity, drops a curtsy, and informs him that she believes his good lady is come. Then there is a crowding, and a whispering at the door, and the good lady enters, with a haughty step. There is no sign upon her face, of last night's suffering. There is no trace in her manner, of the woman on the bended knees, reposing her wild head, in beautiful abandonment, upon the pillow of the sleeping girl. That girl, all gentle and lovely, is at her side a striking contrast to her own disdainful and defiant figure, standing there, composed, erect, inscrutable of will, resplendent and majestic in the zenith of its charms, yet beating down, and treading on, the admiration that it challenges. There is a pause, while Mr. Sounds the Beadle glides into the vestry for the clergyman and clerk. At this juncture, Mrs. Skewton speaks to Mr. Dombey, more distinctly and emphatically than her custom is, and moving at the same time, close to Edith. My dear Dombey, apostrophe said the good mama, I fear I must relinquish darling Florence after all, and suffer her to go home, as she herself proposed. After my loss of today, my dear Dombey, I feel I shall not have spirits, even for her society. Apostrophe. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.